Hey, guys and girls, gals, people, men and women, y'all, how you doing? Oh, that's good, I guess. As far as I know, I can't really hear what you say. But thanks for tuning into the show, whoever you are. You can't hear me if you didn't tune in, so thanks for tuning in. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, I don't know if we'll have a single goddamn interview, man. We got invites out all over the place, but they don't seem to be hitting their mark very well. I wanted to interview Gareth and Phil Giraldi, but they're going to both be out at lunch with each other and therefore not able to talk to me. Oh, cool, man. Sheldon wants to do it. Cool, man. Sheldon Richman's going to be on the show today. Yay! Let me see here. I'm gonna update my tweet, man. Yeah, cool. You know what? I'm going to reply to this other dude, too. Yeah, man. So it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Which means I'm against it.
There's a bunch of wars. Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. Soon enough again
in Libya. Of course, Syria and Iraq. And did I say Yemen? Yeah, well, Yemen three times now. It ain't just a drone war. Now it's a whole big, giant freaking war. With, America serving as the Saudis' proxies, or is it the other way around? You decide. I don't know. But I'm against all of it. So point being that, I got a lot to cover. And I owe you guys an apology, man. I got all excited and went off all half-cocked, premature ejaculating all over the place yesterday, thinking that, they had a deal. Well, Bloomberg said they had a deal. Bloomberg sources say that tonight they are going to make their statement on the nuclear framework. Well, no. That wasn't correct. They backed down from that. They extended the deadline. Now, as Barbara Slavin is reporting, it's not going to be today either. If it's going to be at all, it's going to be tomorrow because they don't want the deal to be announced on April Fool's Day. Because, you know, overly simplistic Fox News talking point and everything. So, they don't have a deal. Not yet. And I'm about to get to this great Gareth Porter article in the next segment explaining what the major holdup is. But, man. Anyway, let me take care of a little business here. The Liberty Radio Network, they let me be on here 5 days a week. They're at LRN.FM, LibertyRadioNetwork.com, and they need your support, too, because they have this deal where they were kind of, I guess, for free as an introductory rate kind of thing, had a satellite over Central Africa. Was it a geosynchronous kind of a thing? I don't know exactly. It was over Central Africa, and there are all kind of little African radio stations playing Liberty Radio Network all the way from Nigeria over to Somalia, from east to west across the central part of that massive continent. And now it's not anymore. But wouldn't that be great if it was again? And I think the cost isn't that much, and if everybody just gives a little bitty bit to the Liberty Radio Network, then we'll be back on over Africa, spreading libertarianism to, all parts of the world need it as bad as we do. But that includes them, too. So if you like the sound of that, go to LibertyRadioNetwork.com, check out their right-hand margin there, and find out how to help support and help get the LRN satellite feed back up over Africa.
so that we can be tuned in. All right. Also, my website is scotthorton.org. Stop by there if you want to check out the interview archives. More than 3,700 of them now, going back to 2003. And, yeah. Also, I should mention this. If you gave to that Kickstarter, never fear, it's happening. The money has been transferred from Kickstarter to the account of the guy, Matt Perry, who came up with the thing. But now our computer genius has a legit problem. His son is very ill. And so, the thing is still happening. I swear to you, man, if you ever believed a thing I ever told you, your money is going to this YouTube project. And if our current computer genius ends up unable to do it, then we'll find somebody else. But the money is not being spent on any other thing, I swear to you. There's a little bit of a delay, but I'm not holding it against this guy because it took us forever to get this Kickstarter up and going long after we recruited him to be our genius to do the script writing and the done doing. So now he's got a real crisis with his son is ill, and so we're going to give him another week or two or whatever it takes. I hope not much longer than that to get back into the swing of things and ready to go. But thank you to everyone who's donated. It took less than a week for us to double the amount that we actually were going for in our goal there. And the project is, and maybe too late now with all the current Google controversy. I don't know how it's going to be, but we're going to try to see if it's effective at all. And we're going to put all 3,700 and something interviews on YouTube in video format. And it's a complicated task. It's why it costs money, because there's a lot of things need lining up. I's need dotting and T's need crossing before we can go. But anyway, that's happening. So if you pledged, if you donated to that Kickstarter, please don't feel like you've been taken advantage of or anything just because you hadn't seen the results yet. It's happening one way or the other. I promise you and thank you. Okay? And then, I guess one more housekeeping thing before we go. I need to give credit to Gage Counts. Gage is my new assistant. I don't pay him a thing. He's just a really nice guy, and he's been helping me to get the guests on the show. And that's why, if you've noticed, especially this year so far, 2015, and I guess the later part of last year as well, you've noticed that the number of guests and the broader range of guests on this show, the range of guests on the show has improved. It's because Gage has been helping me. He's basically producing the show now. I send him a link and I say, get me this guy, and he gets me this guy. And so that is very much to his credit. And so I wanted to go ahead and take a minute to point that out and to thank Gage for all his great work on the show. There's just no question that he has helped to improve the show by huge amounts. Well, if you ask me, I don't know. You can question it all you want if you want, but I'm very grateful. He's been doing a real great job. And it ain't his fault that nobody has said yes today. I gave him a list of 10 people to invite, and I'm pretty sure he invited them all. And we either got no's back or no answer at all. But these things happen. It's a live radio show. I don't know. But I went ahead and got Sheldon. So we'll have Sheldon on, I think, in 15 minutes to talk about some interesting stuff with you guys. So yeah, man, that'll be good. I like Sheldon, man. He's a friend of mine, and I guess I haven't been interviewing him too much lately. But, yeah, and you know what? We're going to switch it up, too. I'm going to interview him about libertarianism, about anarchism, rather than a strict foreign policy interview, although I think we'll start with foreign policy. So that should be good. The great Sheldon Richmond from SheldonRichmond.com be coming up. And then I got more news for you and things after this break. So stay tuned. It's the Scott Horton Show at the Liberty Radio Network, ScottHorton.org. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. and they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Listen, I have not been covering the Boston Marathon bombing trial. And the reason why is because I'm lazy and stupid, and I just have not been paying enough attention at all. But the defense wrapped up yesterday, and so the trial will be over. He'll be convicted and sentenced to either life or death here real soon. And then what I'm going to do, I think, is I'm probably going to interview Cade Crockford from the ACLU and or Marcy Wheeler, both of whom are great and both of whom are very critical of the government's activities here. Very suspicious of the FBI. And I will try my best to get the very best that I can out of them. In fact, I have interviewed Cade Crockford on the Boston bombing before, but that was before the trial. So there's all kinds of new stuff to discuss. I don't think there's really any question whether they did it or not. But then again, who all put them up to it? Who even built the bombs is still an open question. The FBI admits they don't even know who built the bomb. They didn't even try to prove that the Tsarnaev brothers built the bombs themselves. So we've got a real problem there. And I think, you know, they obviously lied about whether they knew who he was, the older brother, Tamerlane, from the very beginning. So, you know, I think that it is absolutely an open question whether he was either that they had attempted to recruit him or they actually had recruited him. Maybe they were playing him as an idiot in one of their fake sting operations and it got out of hand. I don't really know. But I want to know. And I think that, well, you can't really do better than Marcy Wheeler. And again, Cade Crockford has been real good on this too. So I promise, that I will catch up. I will get, one or both of those brilliant women on this show to talk about that story as soon as I can. Okay. So that's my excuse. I just haven't kept up with it because there's just so much other stuff, man. I can't keep up with a damn thing. I work all day, every day, 7 days a week, and I still don't get it done. But anyway, so that's that. All right, now we got Middle East Eye. Iran demands lifting of sanctions for irreversible moves, says Insider. It's Gareth Porter. He's got original, unique sources in Iran. It's the second to the top story today on antiwar.com right now. Iran demands lifting of sanctions in exchange for irreversible moves. As the P5 plus one and Iran agree to continue talks on a possible joint statement past midnight deadline into Wednesday, the most contentious issue in Lausanne still appears to be how and when sanctions on Iran will be lifted. Virtually all the details of the negotiating positions of the two sides remain cloaked in secrecy. However, Middle East Eye has learned from an informed source in contact with negotiators in Lausanne that the core issue remaining to be resolved is whether the P5 plus one will end some sanctions as soon as Iran has taken what it is calling irreversible actions to implement the agreement. Iran has already made some significant concessions on the sanctions issue, the source revealed. Iran and the six-nation group, led by the U.S., have agreed that unilateral U.S. and European sanctions, as U.N. Security Council sanctions that relate to Iran's nuclear program, could be suspended rather than being lifted permanently at the beginning of the implementation of the agreement, a huge concession. The Iranian delegation is also not contesting that the UN Security Council resolutions that forbid assistance to Iran's ballistic missile program and other military programs can stay in place, the source said. But the remaining bone of contention is that the Six Nation group has insisted on maintaining the entire legal system of sanctions in place, even after the sanctions have been suspended, until the International Atomic Energy Agency has reached the conclusion that Iran's nuclear program is entirely for peaceful purposes, a process that it admits could take many years. U.S. and European officials have been telling journalists on background for months that maintaining the sanctions architecture in place is necessary to ensure not only that Iran implements the agreement fully, but also that it has no ambitions to obtain nuclear weapons. But Iran has pointed out to the U.S. and European negotiating teams that it is being asked to carry out curbs on its nuclear program that are effectively irreversible, and which should be reciprocated by the P5 plus 1 with termination of some of the sanctions in each case, according to the source. The source gave examples of Iranian concessions, which Iran argues would be irreversible if implemented, including the redesign of the Arak Heavy Water Reactor, that's ARAK, Heavy Water Reactor, the elimination of its stockpile of low-enriched uranium, and the ratification of the additional protocol to the safeguards agreement by the Iranian parliament. Iran is demanding that the agreement include language calling for the timely ending of sanctions in response to the actual implementation in each case. Iran has agreed to redesign the Arak Heavy Water Reactor, which the P5 plus 1 has called a proliferation threat because of the roughly 10 kilograms of plutonium that it would produce annually. The redesign that Iran has agreed to carry out would reduce the output of plutonium to 1 kilogram per year, according to the source in contact with the negotiators. Therefore, expect the P5 plus 1 to go beyond merely suspending sanctions to reciprocate the implementation of the agreement. A senior Iranian official told the International Crisis Group last June that the redesign of the Arak reactor would involve the replacement of Calandria, the existing vessel that holds the reactor core, with a smaller one. The official said it would take years for Iran to reverse that change and restore the original reactor. Frank von Hippel of Princeton University, a former assistant director for international security in the White House Office of Science and Technology, confirmed in an interview with Gareth Porter at Middle East Eye that the agreed plan for redesigning the Arak reactor does indeed involve the replacement of the Calandria and is, therefore, in practical terms, irreversible. Von Hippel also said the Iranian agreement to reduce its stockpile of low-enriched uranium to a very low level, on top of the reduction of the number of centrifuges to roughly two-thirds of the present operational level, would take about 3 years to reverse. Iranian negotiators are not that concerned about the P5 plus 1 refusal to lift sanctions until Iran provides full information on the possible military dimensions, according to the source. The PMD issue is not a problem, the source said, because Iran is prepared to give the agency all the access it needs as part of the agreement. The much more serious Iranian concern is the six-nation group's insistence that the IAEA must also verify the peaceful nature of the program, as though the implementation of the agreement was not sufficient evidence. Iranian negotiators have pointed out to Western diplomats that the IAEA could take up to 15 years to arrive at a final judgment, as it did in the case of South Africa, the source said. A senior Iranian official told the International Crisis Group last November that IAEA officials, responding to Iran's request about the time required, had refused to rule out the possibility that it would take more than 10 years to complete its assessment of Iran's case. Again, that's Gareth Porter at MiddleEastEye.net. It's the second to top story on antiwar.com today. Iran demands lifting of sanctions for irreversible moves, says Insider, and this goes along with Justin Raimondo's column at antiwar.com today about how, boy, the Republicans in the Congress look like they're going to make sure that, they're going to destroy this thing. They are going to not allow the sanctions to be lifted. On the other hand, Gary Samore, who's a hawk who works for Obama, says he doesn't think that they'll screw it up, but I guess we'll have to wait and see. All right, back in just a minute with Sheldon Richman. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Oy vey. And I'm sitting here arguing with Justin Raimondo on Twitter about Rand Paul. What's to argue? He's the worst person on earth. Okay? He's horrible on everything. Well, luckily, Sheldon Richmond's on Skype, so I didn't have to stop and call him and give you guys dead air. Hi, Sheldon. How are you?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you joining us. Everybody, Sheldon Richmond, he's about as libertarian as a man can be. He's over at SheldonRichmond.com, and he's good on everything. I don't ever have to argue with him about Rand Paul. anyway, so listen, you wrote this great thing about how our government is the cause of any terrorist threat, however overblown, as you stipulate, that the American people face, and how the more they fix things, the more hundreds of thousands of people die all across the Middle East, how they've, in a word, ruined the 21st century so far, the government of the USA has. And you say in there, you know, maybe if we didn't have them, we wouldn't need them. Since, of course, their excuse for us needing them is protecting us from all the enemies that they create for us. Touche. But then, and this comes up from time to time, as you know, oh, yeah? Well, what's the alternative to having a government? Because ever since Westphalia, everybody knows that you got to have 190-something nation states in the world with their guns drawn at each other's heads all the time. And including thermonukes, I guess, and whatever. And by the way, you know, my neighbor a few houses down, he kidnapped some little girls just the other day. So obviously we need cops to prevent things like that. And it wasn't the government that made him a criminal. He's just a criminal. And they let him go, by the way, the cops did. But anyway, that doesn't undermine my wonderful statist argument. We need government because bad countries and bad politicians in other countries and bad people who live in our neighborhoods, Sheldon. And so how could you possibly be an anarchist in the face of this real world that we live in, sir?
yeah, the line about if we didn't have an old line. I first heard it in terms of lawyers, right? They said if we didn't have lawyers, we wouldn't need them. So I figured I thought I'd hijack it and put it to political use. Anyway, the state has gotten us into all kinds of messes, and for intrinsic reasons, politicians, people who run governments, no matter what the form of government it may be, are always going to be essentially unaccountable. Now it's true, in a democracy or republic, if something bad enough happens, someone can get voted out of office, but. Right. We never have recriminations, right? Especially in the United States. We never look backward and bring George Bush to trial for torture and crimes and, misdemeanors. So essentially they can do what they want and they have a lot of secrecy and privacy at their disposal.
Wait. Let me stop you for just a second. I'm getting a little bit of a weird audio thing. So maybe if you're pacing back and forth in your office there or something, try to hold still or something.
No, sure. I'm standing. I'm sitting in a chair.
All right. Well, don't lean forward and back then. Just hold still, Sheldon, while you're talking. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, I'll try. So the people that run governments essentially can pretty much do what they want. There's only minor accountability. The consequences are not very great. Most people aren't paying attention. They're too busy with their lives. They don't, especially when it comes to foreign affairs. They don't know the history. They don't know the esoteric information that would enable them to make better judgments. A lot of stuff is simply done in secrecy, as we know, and you don't find out until years later. So, the governments are, governments have the potential to be rogue, especially if they're the governments of a quote great power like the United States or, any others you can name, Russia or Iran, Iran, all of them. They just can't be trusted. Now, your question is, your point might be, well, okay, I can grant that, but how could we be the only ones who give up the state when everyone else has one? And there, I would say, at least if we gave up the state, we wouldn't have the U.S. government doing what it's been doing, at least since World War II, and probably you can go back before that, in the Middle East, where it's been making enemies and thereby endangering the Americans. So not only endangering and killing foreigners, but I talked about endangering Americans because, as I say in the beginning of the article, the politicians tell us that their first duty is to protect the American people. Okay, let's take them on their own terms. If that's true, why are they constantly embroiling the American people in these sectarian and tribal and political and ethnic and other kinds of disputes that come back to haunt us through blowback and what you call backdraft and other things, so that we can't tolerate this anymore. The government is a troublemaker, gets us into trouble. It doesn't protect us. Could we do better without it? Well, you know, I can't give you a blueprint for how a stateless society would look, because that's the very point. It's spontaneous order. It's bottom up, just like you couldn't tell me what what a free market in computers would look like before it happens. I can't tell you what shape exactly private protection would take. But it's going to be better than the state, because the state serves the ruling class, serves privileged interests, and they don't give a damn about the rest of us, which is why they don't mind, you know, imperiling us.
Well, yeah, I mean, no doubt about that. I can't think of an enemy that wasn't created by the American establishment one way or the other. Even going back to Hitler, I mean, for crying out loud, even the Nazis were bankrolled by the American power elite, those who own the state, the bankers most closely tied to the state, even going back that far. Lend-lease to Joe Stalin to help him turn back the Nazi tide. Then we turn around and make him the biggest enemy in the world to justify the whole Cold War and on like that. But you know, come on. If we didn't have a monopoly on power in D.C. to prevent another one from replacing it, it would be replaced by another one of people maybe even worse. At least we get to vote for these guys, Sheldon.
Get to cast your one vote.
Makes a big difference. Well, a couple things about that. For one thing, if you have a state, especially a national state, rather than, say, highly decentralized, although I wouldn't want a lot of little states either, but that would be preferable to a highly decentralized one. There's, you know, if somebody were outside wanted to take over, it'd be
different, since it wouldn't be this single landmass under one jurisdiction. But if somebody wanted to take that over, they'd have to actually conquer it like household by household. There'd be nothing to surrender, right? You know, the British didn't take very long to conquer India, because it had a very well-developed political structure and class.
You know, put some, buy off some people, put them in charge, and voila, they could rule India for a long time. It took them much longer to conquer Ireland, which was, fairly anarchistic. And, you know, you had to basically conquer it, you know, one, clan at a time. Now, that doesn't mean it's impossible, but it's a heck of a lot, more difficult. And, you know, just because one, little group may surrender, that doesn't mean the next one, you know, next door is surrendering, and they may continue to resist. So I think there's that sort of decentralized defense can be much more effective. And you have to wonder who today is going to try to invade what we call the United States and take it over anyway. The Russians, the Iranians, say what you want about them. I don't think that's on their mind or that they believe they'd be even capable of doing that.
Right. In fact, just yesterday, Yossi Melman, the Israeli intelligence analyst, wrote a story for the Jerusalem Post saying there is no existential threat to Israel, much less the United States of America. If anybody wants to look at a map of just the size, and of course there's the great, I think it's true, it's apocryphal anyway, the Japanese general who said, invade America? Not in a million years. Are you kidding me? There would have been a rifle behind every blade of grass. And he wasn't talking about the army. He was talking about the Californians. So what about the creeps in my neighborhood? There are creeps in my neighborhood, and just because the cops let this guy get away with kidnapping two little girls the other day, I don't know. I guess it's a self-refuting point. I'm an anarchist too, Sheldon. I'm not doing a very good job of playing devil's advocate here, but give me a minute. We got to take this stupid break, and then we'll be back with the great Sheldon Richman. He's going to talk about free market security in our land, in our time, right after this. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. No, seriously, the guy three houses down from me kidnapped two little girls the other night. And then he kept them for like 2 hours. Apparently he didn't touch them or kill them. He brought them back to a street full of flashing red and blue lights, if you believe that. But then they let him go. The fact that he was white and the little girls that he abducted were black, oh, that probably has nothing to do with it, right? Can't imagine if it had been the other way around. But anyway, let's pretend for a minute that he was black and the little girls that he abducted were white. Then he would have gone to prison and then I would have had an argument to make to Sheldon Richman right here. Like, hey, Sheldon, who's going to arrest and prosecute the kidnappers if we don't have a monopoly county police or city police jurisdiction? If we don't have judges who have the right to preclude other judges from deciding and they get to decide and put people like that in cages where they belong.
Well, this anecdote you tell leads me to think, and I didn't know this, that you lived in a little anarchist community. I didn't know that. So you're making a complaint about anarchism because some guy got away with kidnapping some girls.
I guess so.
So I don't understand when people raise an objection to anarchism by pointing to an example that occurred, well, in a context where there are states all over the place. I don't quite get the logic of that.
Right.
I know you did. You didn't mean it that way, but that's all. That often happens. Well, you know, there is some past examples we can look at that have been written about by John Hassness, great libertarian legal scholar, and Bruce Benson, another libertarian legal scholar, about there have been the sort of pockets of history where there was no centralized state, and yet criminal justice was carried out. In fact, it was more carried out in terms of reimbursing or making restitution to the victim rather than sending money to the king, which is what happens today, right? The fine goes to the state and the person may get imprisoned, but the victim usually gets nothing. That's an afterthought. The victim may be able to sue in civil court, but the burden is there then on the victim. So crime wasn't really crime. It was tort, and it was seen as not a breaking of the king's peace or of the society's peace, but of wronging a particular person. And so the whole the thrust of the system was to how to make that person whole as much as possible. And in the case of murder, where of course the victim is gone, the heirs or the family of the victim, there would be some form of restitution to that person. And just like today, we have wrongful death awards, although that's handled in civil court, separate from the criminal court. So the point is, people do figure out a way to do this. We seem, you know, the basic premise here that I'm challenging is that, and it's funny because libertarians don't accept this in other cases, that somehow if it weren't for the politicians and the state, we'd all just be sitting around, you know, twiddling our thumbs saying, gosh, we don't know what the heck to do. We're just going to sit here until, you know, somebody does something for us. That's not what happened. People get up and form mutual aid societies and insurance companies and organizations that vouch for individuals. So you know who you're dealing with, and you know that if this person A that you're dealing with wrongs you, there are procedures for you to file a grievance and a complaint against that person, which then gets heard. I mean, libertarians ought to be reading about the Law Merchant, which was the completely private commercial law that was generated after the fall of the Roman Empire by international traders who didn't want to go into national courts because if you were a foreigner, you didn't trust them. So merchants set up basically their own courts and their own body of law, which we still actually have today. It eventually became, commercial law, but it worked very well. Lots of scholars have studied this. Pete Leeson and George Mason and, other economists have studied this. Political scientists have studied it. And people are able to carry out those so-called legitimate functions of the state without a monopoly state. It's in there in the history.
Yeah, I guess we're just not supposed to pay attention to that. I saw somebody tweeted earlier today I'm paging down to find the quote. It was a quote from Rothbard along the lines of here it is. States always needed intellectuals to con the public into believing that its rule is wise, good, and inevitable. That really is kind of the bottom line, huh? It's all just one big PR campaign.
Right, and the, of course, the story that everybody learns from school, of course, the government controls the schools, no coincidence there, is that the reason we have government was because there was this crying need that wasn't being served by the people, by the general, you know, the people in general. But if, in fact, if you go back and look at the history of states, states are the result of conquest, and by rulers who decide rather than, you know, rob the people and move on to the next group, it makes much more sense to rob the people, stay where you are, and continually rob them and protect them from rival robbers, and then they become grateful to you because you're protecting them. Meanwhile, you're robbing them every day to finance all this, and, you know, doing other stuff like granting monopolies and other kinds of privileges to benefit the your friends, the ruling class. That's how states arise. It wasn't that people sat around saying, "Oh, what are we going to do? We can't protect ourselves. Let's form a state." Okay, it wasn't Thomas Hobbes' story either. So it wasn't a social contract that never happened. It was the result of conquest.
Yeah, and that's that great article, Anatomy of the State, was going out earlier. I was arguing with a so-called libertarian and conservative about the cops, and he was saying, well, they're just here to protect us and this and that. But really where they come from is they're the slave catchers. Man, they're the guys who they're the enforcers of, and I sent him that one where Rothbard says that the state itself, it's just organized criminality writ large. They really are nothing but a gang. And, you know, it's funny because whenever I say, I'll be talking about anti-government stuff, about the worst stuff, the wars, police states, innocent people laying in their corpses, laying in puddles of blood on the side of the road for no reason. And people say to me, oh, you just hate every little old lady that works down at the Social Security office? You deny that any person who works for government could possibly be a good person anyway? Jesus, I'm in the middle of an argument with Just Raimondo on Twitter right now as we speak about this. Oh, anyone that you disagree with about anything is a bad person. No, just Rand Paul is. Doesn't mean every member of his staff that I condemn them, but the Senate itself, yeah. And he's the perfect example. When the son of Ron Paul can't help but be absolutely horrible in the United States Senate, that's time to call the whole project off, if you ask me.
Well, because the incentives, that's the way the incentives work. You know, I've said many times, Ron could say the kinds of things he said without inhibition because he knew he wasn't going to win the nomination and therefore he was never going to be president. But Rand Paul actually, I assume, I don't know him, apparently thinks he can, and therefore he can't blow the opportunity he thinks he has by alienating a lot of other people. So he's got to give this muddied message that he's been giving, which is not even becoming, not even muddy anymore. Now it's sort of just pure intervention. He signed the Cotton Letter. He voted for higher military spending. So it's not even a mixed message anymore. It's like a pure pro-empire message.
Right.
Because he thinks he can win, and the incentives are you got to gather constituencies. So you can't say things that are going to make people mad. And Ron Paul didn't mind making people mad.
Right. Yeah, he was happy to. I mean, if it came to it, right? It wasn't his point, but if you were. And we all remember 08 and 12 especially. He told people what they didn't want to hear all the damn time on the right and the left and everything else. And let the heavens fall. But now, so I don't know why these 10-minute segments just seem to go by in 5 or 6 to me now, Sheldon. But can we spend the rest of the time talking about some good reading material? What would you have people look at if they really want to understand anarcho-capitalism or, you know, whatever it is you want to call it?
Yeah, I don't call it anarcho-capitalism. That's a whole other talk about why I don't like the word capitalism. I think there's good reasons to avoid that word. I like the free market, not capitalism. I would think a very good place to start. It's very accessible. It's not a very long book. And it is like written for the lay reader is Gary Chartier's The Conscience of an Anarchist. You can find that through Amazon or other places. Definitely worth looking at. Rothbard's material is good. I mean, I wouldn't make that all you read because there's been much more that has been written about on this subject since you know, since Rothbard wrote. But I would look at Bruce Benson's The Enterprise of Law, which I've already mentioned. He also will discuss the, in that book, discusses the law merchant and other anarchistic episodes in history. John Hassness has some very good papers on online. One I would look up is, and he's a law professor. I would look up his paper, Toward a Theory of Empirical Natural Rights. Google that and you'll find it. That's definitely worth reading. You can find great work by Roderick Long online, where he's answering objections to anarchism. Just put in Roderick Long objection to anarchism. I think it's like 10 different objections. And that will lead you to other things. All these things have references, and you can follow the trail and read a whole lot about it. There's a huge and growing literature on this subject.
All right, that's Sheldon Richman at SheldonRichman.com. Thanks so much for your time again, Sheldon. Great to talk to you.
My pleasure, Scott. See ya.
All right, we'll be right back, y'all.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Hitting refresh on Laura Rosen's Twitter feed here. She's in Lausanne, however you say it. I don't know, Switzerland. That town in Switzerland where they're negotiating the negotiations. Iran suggests new flexibility over easing of UN sanctions as diplomats press ahead. Consultations still ahead to ensure the outstanding challenges are overcome. I don't know, man. It's so funny. I'm always quoting that Stephen Walt piece where he says, everybody who's not concerned about Iran's nuclear program, ding, ding, me, are the ones who are most concerned with getting this deal. And everybody, those who at least pretend to be so concerned about Iran's nuclear program are the ones who don't want a deal at all. You know what it is? It's because they're lying. It's because they're pretending. It's because they know it's not a nuclear weapons program. They know it's just a pretext for war. They want war. And why? Because Iran supports Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Oh, cry me a freaking river. Hezbollah? You mean the group that did not exist anywhere in time and space until the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 1982 to rout out the PLO and then stayed? Yeah, them. Hezbollah. You mean the guys who are a defensive threat to Israel? Meaning they can, as proven in 2006, keep the Israelis out of Lebanon now? Yeah, them. Oh my goodness, it's like every last Israeli is about to be pushed into the Mediterranean Sea and drowned because of big scary Hezbollah. And in fact, you know, there are times, very rarely, there are times when Netanyahu is honest about this. Like when he's talking with Jeffrey Goldberg, who during the first Gulf War went and joined the army, the Israeli army. And anyway, he helped lie you into war in Iraq from the pages of the New Yorker magazine talking all about Saddam's ties to Osama in 2002 and 3, liar. And, he's basically Israel's commissar in the American media, making sure that nobody falls too far out of line. To know Jeffrey Goldberg is to despise him. But anyway, not that I know him, but I've read enough of him that I despise him. Thank you. Contra Justin, you don't have to actually know a person individually to know that they're bad people. You know what I mean? It's kind of pretty obvious in the case of, say, Jeffrey Goldberg, for example. But anyway, there's an interview
that Jeffrey Goldberg did with Benjamin Netanyahu and Ehud Olmert back in 2000 and I'm going to say 12. I think that's right. Anyway, he interviewed Netanyahu. He went to Israel. Or maybe they came here. I think he was in Israel. And he interviewed Netanyahu and Ehud Barak, who at that time was the defense minister in the Netanyahu government, former prime minister himself and leader of the Labor Party. And they explained, and you go check me. You go check my footnote at The Atlantic and see if you can find this and see if it says what I say it says. But they admitted, both of them, Netanyahu and Ehud Barak admitted, that they're not afraid of an Iranian first strike. That if the Iranians did have a nuke or even some nukes, they do not fear, no matter how many times they lie to you and pretend they do. No matter how many people they convince of their lies, who then turn around and repeat them like tiny brain little mina birds. Netanyahu, in his own words, admits he's not afraid of an Iranian first strike. He knows that they're perfectly rational politicians who do not want to get nuked to death by Israel's hundreds of H-bombs and their, now, was it 6 or 7 submarine second strike capability. You know what he said? He's afraid that Hezbollah might be emboldened. Emboldened. Like embiggened. What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. What, they'll be more willing to whip the IDF's sorry ass like they did in 2006? If the Israelis ever try it again? If Iran has nukes? Why? How so? You're telling me that Nasrallah believes that Iran would come to his defense with nukes? No. What difference would it make whatsoever? None. Ehud Olmert had an even more plausible explanation. Again, nothing to do with an Iranian first strike. He said, well, we're afraid that there would be a brain drain of talented Israeli Jews. That they might go to America to go to graduate school, and then they might stay in America. You know, due to all their irrational fears that we've beaten into their skulls about the risks of an Iranian first strike that we don't believe is actually a problem. A brain drain. This is why millions of Iranians should die. Maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of Americans should die in a war with Iran. So that the Israeli government doesn't have to fear a brain drain of talented Israelis moving to the United States. Yeah, some existential threat to Israel. For God's sake, man. You know, Scott Ritter, and he's got his problems, man, I know. Damn fool. Worse than anything. But anyway, he wrote in his book, Target Iran, back years ago, that the Israeli policy is that an Iranian nuclear program of any description is tantamount to a nuclear weapons program, a nuclear weapons stockpile, I guess. That if they have any nuclear technology at all, if they have any domestic enrichment at all, that is a good enough reason for war, if only they could pull it off. But they can't, so that's why they're always trying to get America to do it for them. That's why Ehud Olmert tried to get George Bush to do it for him back in 2007 and 2008. And first Admiral Fallon, the head of CENTCOM, and then George W. Bush himself said no. And there are very credible sources. Double check them again, my footnotes, man. It was Steve Clemens who broke the story that Dick Cheney sent David Wurmser, the author of the original Clean Break paper. How well'd that work out? The road to Damascus runs through Baghdad. Is that right, David? Anyway, Cheney sent David Wurmser, to the American Enterprise Institute and a couple other think tanks to float the idea. Hey, guys, Dick Cheney's thinking about cutting a side deal with Ehud Olmert, the prime minister of Israel,
to start a war with Iran, thereby forcing George Bush to intervene on Israel's side once the Iranians start hitting them back. Which, of course, they don't even have the range to hit Israel back. I guess the plan actually was that the Iranians would lash out at American interests in the Gulf. And then that would force George Bush into the war. And it was, the story was broken by Steve Clemens, the president of the New America Foundation, which is a center-left, you know, Hillary Clinton-ish Democratic think tank. And it was confirmed, the story was confirmed by the New York Times and the Washington Post. In fact, I think Clemens didn't name Wormser. It was the New York Times that named Wormser. And we are talking about the ultimate in insubordination here. The Vice President of the United States was sick and tired of waiting around for George W. Bush to do the right thing and start bombing Iran. He had pushed very hard for strikes in 2007, earlier that spring. God dang, music playing already? Also, Hirsch reported about how they had a plan. They at least talked about getting special forces to attack the American Navy in the Persian Gulf in a false flag attack. Really? Go look it up. Seymour Hirsch said so. Best reporter in America. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
Man, I'm hungry, and it's still 40 minutes till lunchtime. I wish Ernie would trade with me. I'd get the show out of the way in the morning and then eat lunch when I'm hungry. Get back to work on all the other work I gotta do. Oh, my God. Oh, I had forgotten about this. I'm trying to block it out. It's one of those trauma-based, what do they call that thing where you, like, I knew this kid who was skateboarding across the street, got hit by a car and shattered 15 bones or something. He didn't remember it. It, like, blocked out the event because it was just too traumatic for his brain to have to relive. I've got that about Charles Schumer. Chuck Schumer is in line and apparently no one can stop him. He's going to be the minority leader of the United States Senate. Oh, my God. No. Oh, say it ain't so. Oh, man. Can you imagine? I can imagine. That's my problem. And, boy, I ain't like no Harry Reid, man. I don't want Harry Reid. But these are my choices. These are our choices. In fact, I got a great Charles Schumer quote for you here somewhere. Let me see if I can find it. Oh my God, Charles Schumer, the leader, at least the minority party. Not that I like having the Republicans in the majority, but for crying out loud, man. Oh man, where's my goddamn? Oh, I know where it is. I know where it is. If this Explorer window will ever show me what's in it. My thingy's bogging down here, man. All right, where are you at? God dang Charles Schumer. Oh, my God, Charles Schumer. Can you imagine? Oh, I already asked that. Charles Schumer. Chuck Schumer. It's bad enough he's a senator. He's going to be the leader of the Democratic senators now? God help us. I don't really believe in God, but I'll tell you what, God, I'll make you a deal. I will start believing in you right now if you will help keep Charles Schumer from somehow becoming the minority leader of the Imperial Senate. I just don't think I can take it, man. Where is the damn clip? You know, I can just never find the clips I'm looking for when I'm looking for them. I'm going to find this one, though. I know it's in my Waco folder. I just got to go find my Waco folder. Got it all different places here. Dang stupid Chuck Schumer. Piece of garbage. Yeah, there it is. Oh, good. You know what? I got a few little Schumer clips here.
A private for something playing? High-ranking talent.
Oh, no. Something else is already playing. What's playing?
It's not in Chrome. Is it in Mozilla? Yeah. Whatever was playing was in Mozilla, I guess. It must have been CNN and their damned autoplay. God, I hate them. All right, let's see here. Here's my favorite one. Here's the one that I was thinking of.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
Yeah, exactly. That's a reference to how we're supposed to all believe that the Branch Davidians all murdered themselves, as opposed to being murdered by the FBI hostage rescue team, which is what they call their assassin squad, and the Delta Force, Combat Applications Group, Team B. And in fact, along those lines, here's Schumer denying that Clinton had anything to do with this, as though we're supposed to believe that Janet Reno can order the Delta Force into battle. Really? The Attorney General? I mean, I know she had the word general in her title and everything, but seriously, if you believe that Janet Reno ordered the Combat Applications Group Team B to massacre the Branch Davidians, then, I don't know, you're stupid.
It's a serious allegation.
Yeah.
That the president interfered with, changed, moved up the decision. And we can't just bandy these things around unless we have some real evidence.
That's right. Oh, yeah, no, there's no real evidence as long as you don't read the Dallas Morning News.
Now, maybe the government, the FBI, the ATF did some wrong things, but they didn't light the fire. They didn't start the fire.
Yeah, they
that
did.
Is not one of these questions. That is very debatable.
Yeah, it's extremely debatable. Well, actually, it's not debatable, but in the other way around. Mike McNulty found the flashbang devices, incendiary round or pyrotechnic rounds, at all three origins of the fire. And we got the FBI's own infrared footage of Delta Force and FBI agents getting out of the tanks and shooting the Branch Davidians to death with their machine guns. And we also know from Stephen Barry, who is a former Delta Force officer, explaining that, and with plenty of evidence to back him up, that the Delta Force went in there under Bill Clinton's orders. They were killing those people, and they put a bomb on the floor of the second floor level of the 1 3-story part of that Branch Davidian house, so-called compound. The one concrete room, the vault, where only women and children were found, their corpses were found. Some of them poisoned to death, some of them exploded to death, some of them baked to death, some of them crushed by falling concrete from the bomb that Delta Force placed in the center of that room, the center of the ceiling, the roof above that room on the floor of the second floor. It was a mass murder by the government. Simple as that. There was no suicide. Anybody who told you that there was a suicide there, they're lying. Or they're stupid and they let liars tell them things and then they believe them.
Do you doubt that there were 48 illegal weapons and
hand
grenades?
I've never said
there?
I knew all the details of the trial.
Do you
I've
doubt that? I'm
that
asking you that
peaceful.
Right now, sir.
What is your question?
My question is, do you have doubts that Mr. Koresh had on his compound illegal weapons and illegal hand grenades?
No,
do you have any doubts about that?
No, he told
Thank
me
you.
He had illegal
okay.
weapons
Do you
there.
Have
he
doubts?
He did not tell me that he had hand grenades there.
I see.
And I
okay.
saw no hand grenades. I did see some grenades that the ATF had thrown in, and I brought one out.
What do you mean thrown in?
The ATF threw in grenades in their dynamic entry.
No, they didn't throw
entry,
any
Mr.
grenades in, as I
yes,
understand
they did.
It.
They I brought
flash,
one out.
They were flashbacks. They did
Have
not
Have you ever
explode.
Seen what a flashbang can do to somebody? It's a grenade. It has an explosive charge in it. It's very dangerous. It can blow your hand off. It can blow your face off. It can kill. I would have brought out some of the unexpended grenades that the ATF threw in, but I was worried about bringing out a live grenade, so I left them there. There were a number of grenades.
Okay, Mr. DeGaren, I think that would hamper your credibility because you're the first person who would say that those were grenades.
Well, Mr. Barr, a flashbang grenade, my answer is no. I would not want to hold it.
Those are classified as destructive devices under 26 U.S.C. Section 5845F, aren't they?
Yes, sir, they are.
That they can kill people, is that true?
Certainly, yes, sir.
Well, a gentleman by the name of Warren L. Parker, an explosives enforcement officer, Bureau of ATF, on May 11, 1994, in court, said under oath that they are designed to help kill the suspect while not endangering the law enforcement officer when they're used for those purposes.
There is, in my judgment, it is absolutely clear that no law was violated, no action was taken that comes close to violating posse comitatus or any other law. General Huffman, is that your, do you agree with that?
Congressman, so far as the Army's involvement in this, I would say that is correct.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on Liberty Radio Network. Live every day from noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time. So I don't know, man. I guess I need to talk about... I got to reopen my Mozilla now. I had to kill it so I could play that Schumer stuff for you. We need to talk about Yemen. And by the way, I got a lot of sound bites organized, so, you know, when I have those problems, as I do from time to time, where I got to call a guest in the middle of a segment, and then I got to try to figure out, what sound bite am I going to play for them, and that kind of thing. I got plenty now. I got them all lined up. Some really good ones. In fact, I could just sit here playing them all for 10 minutes if I wanted to. There's so many. But anyway, here, let me get to the Yemen thing, man. So our good friend, Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Where the hell is his article here? What'd I do with it? All right. Well, the article's lost. I'm going to find it again. Here it is at antiwar.com today. Yemen's Houthis are no Iran proxy, writes Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. I was asking on Twitter, does anybody have proof that Iran is backing the Houthis? Everywhere, even Tom Englehart said, yeah, the Iran-backed Houthis. Show me. God dang it, I don't want to hear a quote from an anonymous source. I want, at least give me an anecdote. Now, actually, Eric Garris said he heard an anecdote. He didn't see any proof of it. But he heard an anecdote that the Iranians have been sending a couple of planes full of guns over there lately. But apparently just small arms. Again, and he wasn't vouching for it. He was just telling me, hey, I did hear an anecdote, but there was no proof of it. And even if that's true, that hardly amounts to anything anyway. But, oh my God, all over the place. Just like everybody knows Saddam's making nuclear bombs. How are we ever going to stop him? Everybody knows Iran's making nuclear bombs. How are we going to, you know, anytime in politics, something starts with everybody knows and the sentence doesn't end with and that Chuck Schumer and Rand Paul are equally horrible men. It's just, you should not believe it. Especially when it's an accusation against a foreign power and especially when it's one that Israel doesn't like. But so I just said, hey, man, I don't doubt it. Why wouldn't the Iranians back the Houthis? They are sort of kind of Shiites. And obviously Iran has a proxy battle with Saudi Arabia going on in Iraq and Syria right now. So, you know, I don't know. I don't dismiss it. I don't love the Ayatollah. Half the time I'm defending his nuclear program and half the time I'm accusing him of
making of helping the Americans ruin Iraq forever. I carry no brief for the mullahs, but just show me, man. If you're going to prove some things, show me some proof. Not two anonymous administration officials agreed on the same accusation. So Jason Ditz wrote this up. Yemen's Houthis are no Iran proxy. In fact, he found the same thing I found when I was looking for this. WikiLeaks, the heroic Chelsea Manning, who is doing 35 years in the brig now for your sins, released the Iraq and Afghan war logs in the State Department cables, and included in those State Department cables is a write-up about the Houthis in Yemen. Yemen's Houthis are no Iran proxy. Shiite militia has roots in domestic politics, writes Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Declaring their war against the Houthis of Yemen last week, Saudi Arabia has presented the conflict as a sort of noble intervention, aiming to displace an Iranian proxy from power in favor of the internationally accepted, if not legitimately elected, President Hadi. Yet the history of the Houthis shows that far from an intervention of Iran, an invention of Iran, their origins were entirely domestic in nature, a backlash against the political corruption that has defined the nation for decades. WikiLeaks documents from the U.S. State Department underscore this history. The Houthi movement has its origins in the 1993 parliamentary elections. Longtime dictator Ali Abdullah Saleh's GPC party won a plurality, but in trying to ensure a weakened opposition, Saleh negotiated a deal with Hussein al-Houthi, a powerful member of the opposition Al-Haq party. Houthi was to distance himself from Haq and back the GPC in return for support from the ruling party. Houthi did as he was asked and was stabbed in the back in the 1997 election when Saleh's office heavily campaigned against him, costing him his seat in parliament. Out of office, Hussein decided to travel abroad to complete his doctorate. He returned in 2001 and became an influential religious leader, aiming to unite the various independent clerics of Zaydi Shiism under a single banner. They're fivers as opposed to twelvers, which I don't understand that much, but the fifth imam is the one that they make the big deal about rather than the 12th one. So I don't know. Whatever. Successful in this, he began publicly condemning Saleh as a U.S. puppet, while harshly condemning the U.S. invasion of Iraq. By 2004, the Yemeni military was moving against Houthi and his followers, and Hussein was killed on September 10, 2004, putting a temporary end to hostilities. Hussein's father, Badr al-Din Houthi, started an uprising in 2005, and his brother, Abdel Malik Houthi, started an even bigger one in 2007. Their demands centered around equal treatment for their homeland around Saada, which always got the short end of infrastructure investment. By 2009, the region was in a full-scale war, with Saleh vowing to defund public schools and all other basic social spending to pay for weapons to wipe the Houthis out. Saleh often accused the Houthis of being an Iran proxy, though the State Department confirmed that this was not the case, and indeed that the Houthis were arming themselves almost entirely through the black market and purchase of arms from the Yemeni military itself. With interests largely domestic and often not even nationwide, and religion never more than tangentially related to their ideology, the Houthis never made sense as allies to Iran. The Zaydi branch of Shia Islam isn't even particularly close to Iran's own version, and Hussein Houthi's opposition to the Iraq War, which benefited Iran greatly, reflects how different the two are. The Houthis were largely defeated in 2009, though they began to reassert themselves in 2011 during the Arab Spring. This was temporarily calmed by the 2012 ouster of Saleh and his replacement in a single-candidate vote, General Hadi. Hadi followed through on attempts to weaken the Houthis by implanting Sunni Islamist factions in the Saada area, which led to another war in 2014. This time, the Houthis won outright and marched on the capital city of Sana'a. Here, too, they were victorious. The takeover of the capital set the stage for an on-again, off-again battle with Hadi, and the Houthis were pushing heavily for constitutional reforms and free elections, a point on which Hadi resigned in January of 2015. His resignation lasted a few weeks. Then Hadi declared himself unresigned, moving to Aden and vowing to take the country. When the Houthis routed him yet again, Hadi fled to Saudi Arabia. This is last week we're talking now. And courted their military intervention to ensure his rule. Never has serious evidence of Iranian involvement been seen. And the new claims that loyalists to Saleh are fighting alongside the Houthis are strange indeed, given their history of acrimony. If Iran gets involved in the Houthi-Saudi war at all, it is because of their regional rivalry with the Saudis, as both sides are keen to wound the other when the opportunity presents itself. To this day, however, the Houthis maintain that they have no ties with Iran and intend to defend the countries by themselves. And, of course, unsaid in here, just for time and space, is that the Houthis are fighting Al-Qaeda, America's enemy. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And then he refers to this a little bit here, and this was something that I mentioned to you guys yesterday, that article from The Telegraph that said that that Saleh is now backing the Houthis against Hadi, trying to get his old job as dictator back again. And all of this, of course, much of this, is because of American intervention, the drone strikes, and all of the military and financial support to Saleh in the name of the war against Al-Qaeda, which he used, as Jeremy Scahill wrote in The Nation a few years back even, he was using against all of his own enemies and stirring up more problems and destabilizing the whole damn country. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, that's right. America is working to restore democracy in Yemen. That's why we're backing the Saudis and the Egyptians and the United Arab Emirates. We're backing every king and sultan and emir and military dictator in the region to restore the one man on the ballot to his democratically elected position as president of Yemen. Yeah. Well, of course, you understand democracy means, when in terms of a foreign country, democracy means you do what America says or we'll kill you. They don't care of kings. Look at Egypt. In Egypt, and I know people get all paranoid about the Muslim Brotherhood because it has the word Muslim in it, and they're not the nicest guys. I ain't carrying any water for their sorry asses either. But they're really just Republicans is all they are. The leadership, at least the former leadership, they're all in jail awaiting their death penalty now, the ones who aren't already dead. But circa 2011, the Muslim Brotherhood is a bunch of rich old guys, man. A bunch of property owners. A bunch of conservatives. Not radicals. Not bin Ladenites. Not revolutionaries. They're doctors and lawyers and landowners. Although on the outside, mostly, of the military establishment, which really rules all of Egypt and its economy, too. But when the people, and that ain't oversimplifying it, really, when the people, like all of them, overthrew the Mubarak American sock puppet military dictator regime that we had supported there for 30 years for Israel's sake in 2011, they demanded elections. And the Muslim Brotherhood won by kind of bare majorities. But they won the parliamentary elections, two different parliamentary elections, I think it was, and a presidential election. And the military and the ruling military council had excluded all of the, most likely presidential candidates of the Muslim Brotherhood for various reasons. And so they ended up with Mohamed Morsi, who was, the Rand Paul of their party or whatever. There's kind of, he wasn't a very good damn leader anyway, but he was elected. But then what happened was, the
so-called liberals of Egypt, they blew it. They really screwed up bad. And instead of siding with the process, that we would rather have a democratic process for choosing and replacing leaders, we would rather have the military than the Muslim Brotherhood, right? It'd be like if the American Democrats supported the Pentagon doing a coup d'etat to get rid of Jeb Bush. We don't want Jeb Bush. We'd rather have a military dictatorship under Admiral, or is it General Dempsey, than Jeb Bush. That was basically the calculation that the idiot so-called liberals, the young and somewhat left-wing, the socialists and the whoever else on the left in Egypt, that was the stupid decision that they made. And so then they aided and abetted, really, as bad as the Muslim Brotherhood were at exercising power. They only had it for a year and a half. And then the military, in the summer of 2013, overthrew Morsi and locked all his guys in jail. And then they had a fake election with 0.01% turnout that came. And now Field Marshal Sisi is the new so-called president, but he's just a military dictator. He's just Hosni Mubarak incarnate. Replaced him. John Kerry, the American Secretary of State, said this was the restoration of democracy. I swear to you, he really did say that. A military dictator overthrowing a democratically elected leader in a coup d'etat is the restoration of democracy. Well, then they had problems because the laws say, which I don't know how they ever got these laws passed in the first place in America, but anyway, they have these laws that say that you can't give military aid to governments that come to power in illegal military coup d'etats, man. But, of course, there's no law that binds the power and authority and activities of the U.S. government. And so they've been selling them weapons all along. Helicopters, planes, guns, whatever they need. And now they're even getting rid of the pretext. U.S. ends curbs on military aid for Egypt junta. Certain aspects of U.S. military aid to Egypt were frozen in late 2013, writes Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com, following the summer military coup in that nation and the extremely bloody crackdown on supporters of the ousted democratic government. The U.S. was never particularly fond of the elected government in Egypt at any rate, and it seemed fairly reluctant to impose the curbs at all, which President Obama today has announced are being released to support Egypt's regional wars against extremists. That is, I left out the part about how the Saudis really backed the coup as well. Remember, Phil Giraldi, go back and check the archives, in January and February of 2013, Giraldi said that he's a former CIA officer, if you're not familiar. He said on the show that his sources were saying the Saudis are bankrolling rent-a-mobs in Cairo to try to create unrest and set the stage for the coup. There it was unfolding right before our eyes in super slow motion. So the Saudis are big on that, and the Egyptians, as I just said, are joining in the Saudis in their war in Yemen. That was my military dictator reference there. America backing all the kings and emirs and sultans and military dictators of the region to go restore one man on the ballot democracy in Yemen. Anyway, Obama has announced, Obama has announced today, that's yesterday, that the curbs are being released so they can help support Egypt's regional wars against extremists. Did I leave out about how America's coordinating the entire war in Yemen? Of course, from their ships out at sea and their AWACS planes in the air. And I'm sure the State Department is helping coordinate all the different governments in the region, etc. It's America's war in Yemen. Don't let them tell you that it's just the Saudis and Egyptians. Reportedly, Obama delivered the news to junta head Abdul Fattah al-Sisi personally. Though the wars weren't too directly referenced by U.S. officials, they include Egypt's attempts to install a military dictator of Libya, nominally to battle ISIS and their involvement in the Saudi war in Yemen, which is an attempt to restore an ousted military dictator there. The U.S. aid includes 12 F-16 fighters and 125 tank kits, part of $1.3 billion in foreign aid provided by the U.S. annually to the massive Egyptian military, which, again, the military just completely dominates the entire society, culture, and economy there in Egypt, and just ain't no going back from that. In fact, what was I reading the other day, man? I had something here about Egypt where they talked a little bit. It wasn't this New York Review of Books thing. I still need to get back to this. But there was something about, what was it I was reading that had, it was all about Morsi's attempts to placate the military and their refusal to go along. They just were never going to accept a Muslim Brotherhood government there. And here's one of the things that's the most important about this, as far as Americans need to be concerned, is that right after the coup, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of al-Qaeda hiding out in Pakistan, put out a podcast saying, "See, I told you. The Americans will never let Islamists come to power, even by fair and free elections. See, I told you. The Muslim Brotherhood are fools for playing the game at all. See, I told you. If we're ever going to be out from under secular North American white Christian-backed military dictatorship in Cairo, it's going to be because you join me and start blowing their asses up." And with all the old men, conservative, rich, old Republican-type leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood rotting in prison awaiting their death penalties, that means that the young and pissed off and much more likely to listen to Zawahiri are now rising to the top of what's left of the Muslim Brotherhood, and so we'll be reaping the whirlwind here in just another little while when it comes to the soon enough rise of al-Qaeda in Egypt. We already got ISIS in the Sinai.